Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith. And today we are joined by Anthony Barese.
Hello.
How are you today?
Yeah, how are you today?
I'm good. Good.
It's great. I got a message from like a month ago and you were like, let's just pick this day. And I was like, cool. And then...
Hey, because you made a Facebook post saying like, if anyone wants to be on the show, just let us know. And I thought, all right,
why not? Yeah, we have a magical... practice of doing that. People are always like,
did you get a bunch of responses to that?
We've had a weird in the last 2 years we've done 310 episodes, and yeah. there's not been a time like, we'll have slow periods where like for a week we'll have like an episode or two. But I mean, we'll still pretty much always have at least one episode. And
at least one episode a week.
Yeah. And usually that kind of a status, whenever I post like, let me know if you want to come on. It's not because we don't have people on. It's always just like, because it always ends up being someone that's never been on.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah.
If I post something like that, people are always like, oh, I had no idea that I could just come on your show. It's like, yeah, because so if you're listening.
Yeah.
Shoot me on the show. Yeah, come
message,
on the show.
Message me.
Well, and it's always rad because it's always like very dope, interesting people, because you do so much stuff. So I'd love to like get into because we met. I mean, was the 4th of July concert when we met?
No, we met a couple of weeks before that to rehearse.
Yeah.
Yeah. We rehearsed.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'd known your work with Chicago Folks Operetta,
right.
And you do so much. So let's actually get it. Would you mind, for those that maybe don't know, because there's a lot of folks that listen that aren't also opera people, introducing who Anthony Barese is?
I like to say I'm a musician because that's the most blanket statement. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's the least pretentious, you know, like I hate saying I'm an artist, you know, when people say that, it's like, fuck off. Like, do you paint? No, you know. Mm-hmm. so musician just kind of covers it all. I studied composition in undergraduate and graduate, and then I also did a lot of conducting, like my own work, and then I also grew up with a love of opera through my dad and going to the opera a lot. And so after college, I was in Italy, and these things kind of came together, the conducting and the musicianship, and so I make my living basically doing conducting, opera conducting, but I still, you know, love composition. I still like performing just sort of privately, but I you know, all music is what interests me, just kind of any, you know, putting together sounds and working with people, and that's pretty much what really gets me excited.
I really appreciate the way that you think about it. And this might be jumping down a rabbit hole, but let's go for it.
Let's do it.
I think the thing that I think about a lot is, because you've kind of like hinted at this in the way that you've talked about it, is a lot of people think of opera as like, oh, I don't know how I want to put this, like not music.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It can sometimes be like created as like treated as an other.
Because of the theatrical form. Effect, you mean? Or because of the theatrical component?
Let's start here. When you were thinking about like, I want to be making music, like, did you specifically think I want to be an opera composer? Like, I want to be like a great.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's kind of, you know, I just wanted to be a composer. I wanted to create music. And whether that was through, you know, writing it down, you know, composing is a very lonely act.
Mm-hmm.
And conducting is a very social act, you know, and I'm kind of a little bit of introvert and a little bit extrovert, and this kind of feeds both needs. But like, I think it's, you know, we've never had such access to so much music ever in history.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never had so much access to so much bad music, you know, like I like to, I mean, this is wonderful. Like, there's nothing going on here, right? There's no music playing. Like, you can't avoid music. You go to Walgreens, there's something playing. You know, you go to any restaurant, there's music. In fact, if there were not music playing, people would be uncomfortable and they wouldn't even know why. So like, I like the idea of making music with people because it's actually special. It's you know, I could turn on Spotify, I can go on YouTube and find anything recorded ever, but to make music with people is a unique experience, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think is really interesting. Just like, I because especially with like classical music, like when it's if there's such a unique disconnect with like what the general public consumes,
yeah,
and how, you know, sometimes I do this thing a lot where we'll be talking to someone and I'll say, yeah, we come from opera, and mm-hmm. then something, it's always a different it's always a different reaction,
right?
But I kind of know going into it why I say that, and then I always think like, man, because not all opera people are just opera people. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And,
well, so I think that the context that we bring it up most often on this show is when there's a conversation surrounding tradition and people who are stuck in that tradition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, typically we'll be talking about, you know, whether that be theater, whether, you know, whatever it is, we'll be like, well, we come from opera. And so I think that there's a certain level, I think that opera kind of has a perception problem at the moment where sure. people outside of opera who are also artists.
Yeah.
You know, don't necessarily have the best view of it because it's one of those, it has the perception, and obviously that is not the case because, mm-hmm. you know, being of the opera community and in the opera world, like obviously there's revolutionary work being done.
Oh, sure.
But I think that what's happening in terms of like public perception is that they're like, oh, well, you know, it's that's old just fashioned a, that's a yeah. stodgy institution.
It's, which is fascinating because opera historically has always been on the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were trombones in the orchestra of Don Giovanni decades before anyone used them in a symphony. I mean, mm-hmm. Monteverdi was using, you know, orchestral instruments before anybody else. I mean, in opera, like opera has always been, for me at least, in music history, at the forefront of the most creative and the least conservative traditions.
Well, and that is exactly where I meant to get at, which is I think it's interesting to have the background that you did of having an appreciation for opera and then saying, I want to be writing new opera. Like, what does that mean for you? Like, what, because you have that understanding and appreciation for like what a lot of people come to opera for, which is the, like the
drama,
history,
the excitement.
It,
yeah.
Yeah. What does making new opera mean to you?
Oh boy. I've only written one opera, and it's a children's opera, and it's not, you know, it's not the most daring thing in the world, but I think, you know, there is more, you know, great new opera going on now than you know, any other time in my lifetime. You know, there are constantly, you know, new works being premiered at a faster rate. I mean, even the Met, which, you know, for years didn't do anything new, mm-hmm. is finally doing new works and new works and new works in Chicago Opera Theater. And, you know, we have, and so I just think that the question then becomes, I think what, kind of going back to what you had said about it being stodgy, I think the reason that is because it's stuck in a museum setting of just this calcified repertoire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the question then becomes, well, what are the new pieces that are being now written now that are going to enter into the repertoire, or are any of them, or are we going to just going to be a repertoire-less art form where it's, because when Rossini was writing, he wasn't writing, you know, for posterity. Like if he came back now and saw that I was doing Tancredi or something, he'd say, are you fucking nuts? Like why, like why I wrote that when I was 21, like, you know, what, do yeah. a new opera, you know, like opera, it'd be like going to the movies and seeing Gone with the Wind or something, or, you know, or some movie yeah. made like, you know, a number of years ago. So it does seem like, because so few new works are catching on in a real way. You know, they catch on in that, you know, you have co-productions and stuff. Yeah. And so like from like a business point of view, they're going to have legs a little bit. But how many of these pieces are going to catch on and then be done in 100 years?
You know, this is in terms of operatic institutions, we have the opportunity to work with the Youth Opera Council at Lyric Opera, where we recorded it. The students who were part of that interviewed Anthony Barese. Or not, you're Anthony Barese.
I'm Anthony Barese.
Anthony Freud.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Big
and,
difference.
Yes, very big difference. And
salary,
I'm about to tell you why. in that interview, he was talking about programming a season, and he pulled out of his pocket a spreadsheet.
Oh, wow.
That he was like, this piece of paper right here is what we have programmed for the next 10 years at Lyric Opera.
10 years.
And like,
but that is going to change. That, those things go through changes.
Oh, I know.
And we, I remember we like pushed back to some degree about it conceptually, and then we're immediately like, no, I mean, like, yes, it's written down, but there is some room for flexibility. But it is, it is an interesting mindset thing. You know, you bring it up too, the idea of, because that is also a thing I think about, like, when we think about how the history of music will be told like 100 years from now, like what thing, like the thing with opera is that because it also has that museum setting quality, I love that you said that, that was the exact words that was coming to my mind then too, like we have this there, it's always like when someone writes a new song now,
yeah,
that's, you know, I'm really into TikTok right now.
Okay.
TikTok is just it's like, have you heard of Vine?
Oh, yeah.
TikTok's like the next Vine.
Okay, because Vine didn't exist anymore, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But TikTok started out as this is such a tangent, but okay. But stick with me, I promise it makes sense. TikTok started out called Musical.ly, and so it was a, and we talked about this in the last episode of the podcast, but it was a lip syncing app. So a lot of music got popular on TikTok because people were lip syncing to it, like certain moments were funny or whatever.
Wow.
And then all of the Viners that were disillusioned from the ending of Vine all got on TikTok and started making stuff that wasn't lip syncing. And then the two parties, the two like factions, the intense lip syncers,
the Jets and the Sharks,
right? Yeah. And the Viners were kind of, and now TikTok is in this weird position where it's both,
it's the it thing right now.
It's the it thing, but it has the comedy from Vine and the lip syncing from Musical.ly,
and
now it's comedic lip syncing.
And it's, so in the context of this conversation, the reason I bring it up is because music, it's the Snapchat energy of like, you post something on Snapchat and it's gone the next day.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Sure.
And like the music that gets popular on TikTok, some of it's like interesting music that I would have never heard of otherwise that are good songs. Like have you heard of the song that Billy Ray Cyrus?
And then the hip hop guy. Yes. I've heard of
that
it.
That is from TikTok. and it's
perfect.
And it's this wild kind of bridging of. Oh, I don't know, like
styles and stuff, right? Like, because I heard it hit like number one in the you know, Billboard, but it didn't for pop, but like for country, it's not nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing because, well, and it's that kind of spectrum is really interesting to me in this conversation, specifically because with opera, like so much of even stuff that's like new opera that's written. When we're thinking about the balance of what, how it will be received and how it's produced and all these things, the balance of like the longevity of it is always considered. Whereas like something like Vine or TikTok or Snapchat, like it's gone in a day. And that like spectrum of like, I don't even know what to call that. Like the longevity of
how the staying power for sure. I mean, that's why I love opera, because you know, in the 90s, there was a period in the 90s where people were like, Oasis is the biggest thing in the, you know, they're going to be around forever. Yeah. And like, they're bigger than the Beatles. They're bigger than Jesus. Like Oasis. And it's like, now who the fuck is Oasis? You know, like, but Aida has been around for well over 100 years. It is not going anywhere. It's still being done by opera companies all over the world. They still love to do it. People love to see it. And that's kind of what I like about opera too. It's also a super high stakes game. Like I can make a little song on my phone and put it on, you know, like an app or something like that. And like you said, it'll be gone in a day, or maybe it'll be a huge hit. But it'll eventually, it's gonna leave. Like it's eventually gonna like be like Oasis. It's gonna be gone. But opera is so expensive to produce. It requires so many different people, so many different talents and costuming and play people, you know, music and lighting and all this stuff. The most likely scenario is that it's going to get one production and then that's it, you know, but it costs so much money and there's so much riding on it, you know, that's why I kind of just love it. It's just, it's very high stakes in that way.
Mm-hmm. I would be, so another thing that you do in the opera world is that you are part of a young artist program.
I'm an artistic director of Opera Southwest in Albuquerque, and we're going our fifth year now. An apprentice program, yes.
Gotcha. So we've talked a fair amount about young artist programs.
Sure.
You know, us being semi-young opera singers. semi-young. We've talked a lot about kind of the ethics behind it, the way that people tend to be treated in them, kind of the drama behind the onboarding process in those young artist programs. Yeah. But we've never talked to somebody who is involved in the day-to-day of a young artist program. Sure. So would you mind talking to us a bit about the apprentice program?
So we started the apprentice program mainly because, you know, my philosophy at Opera Southwest, you know, when we were only doing two operas, it was like we needed to do one opera that's going to get people there, and then I want to do something that's off the beaten path, and we would balance it that way. Mm-hmm. And the off the beaten path didn't have to be, you know, crazy stuff. It could be like Italian Girl in Algiers paired, you know, with Traviata or something like that. Sure. But then the more we started doing that, the more we started getting more success with the off the beaten path pieces. And they started getting more and more off the beaten path, which eventually in 2014, we did the first performance since 1871 of this, a treatment of Hamlet. It's called Amleto by a contemporary of Verdi's Franco Faccio, who was a scapigliatura, which you take the name of your show from, which was a group of young Milanese artists who were very into just being the music of the future or the artwork of the future. So this was a manifesto, Amleto, and it had not been done since 1871. It was Arrigo Boito's first libretto that he'd ever written. They were in their 20s, Faccio and Boito. And we did this piece, and it was a huge success for us. But even in the run-up to the piece, I thought, well, if somebody gets sick, I can't call anybody. Like, nobody knows this piece because it hasn't been done since 1871. So I said, we have got to get covers. So it started out as this idea of we have to get viable covers. And while they're there, you know, there's enough roles in this that we can give some of them compromario roles and some can be in chorus and some can do this and that. But also, having been a young artist and talked to a lot of singer friends and seen a lot of young artist programs, everybody knows that the reason the young artist programs exist, by and large, are to get cheap or pretty much free chorus, right? It's like one of the best young artist programs, allegedly in the country is the Santa Fe Apprentice Program. And they have the best, you know, they have the best chorus probably of any opera, company in the world, because they have 24 or 30 of the best, youngest, most hungry singers possible. But they also get other things in Santa Fe. They get to sing for agents. They get to do all this other things. That some of them get work in operas. But then you go down the line, you know, and then you get these opera companies that barely deserve to exist at all, and they have apprentice programs, and they're basically just chorus. So I said, we started it because we needed covers for obscure repertoire. But from the very beginning, my dream was to eventually get to the point where we're offering them something beyond an opportunity to learn a role that you're never going to do again after this one time.
Right.
So this year, actually, after the fourth year, we started in 2014, this is 2019, we were able to produce an opera just for the apprentices, and not with an orchestra in a theater. So like the whole idea was we needed people to cover roles in Lohengrin and to do small roles and to do, we definitely needed them for chorus in Lohengrin. Yeah. Like Lohengrin's an enormous chorus, but we offered them the chance also to sing. We got six people, and they did all the roles in Rossini's first opera, Cambiale di Matrimonio. And we had an orchestra, and, you know, I played the harpsichord, and we did it in a theater. And so that was sort of the carrot to get them there.
Right.
And that's something that I really, like, for me, that was the highlight of having an apprentice program. If you can give young singers an opportunity to do their own opera, you know, with orchestra, with costumes, with the whole, you know, nine yards. And to me, there's nothing better than that. There's nothing more important for a young singer to do than basically to have a performance opportunity. But a real performance opportunity.
Right.
Not like in a church basement with a piano and you have to bring 10 friends and you have to buy a spaghetti dinner. You know, some kind of bullshit thing, you know, which... So trying to be as little predatory as possible, even though kind of the nature of it is... You know, you're praying on. And also, like, I've been a huge advocate. We don't charge a fee for, we've never charged a fee for auditioning.
Yeah.
Starting this year, we don't even charge for the piano player. We get a piano player, and that the cost, because people are flying from all over the country.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. However, more people, like six people canceled like within 24 hours of the audition. So what we might do in the future is we might say there is a refundable deposit. Like there's a deposit if there's like $40 deposit, whatever. And if you show up, we tear the check up. But if you cancel before 24 hours beforehand, we get to keep that money because you're wasting my time. You're wasting the pianist's time.
Yeah.
Like you're wasting a lot of people's time. So it's really, you got to find that balance. Cause I know like in the Facebook groups, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, let's boycott companies that don't that charge a fee, which if every tenor did would work, but you know, I mean the reality, like for this we're hiring six apprentices for this upcoming opera in October. One role is a soprano, one is a woman, period. Yeah. You know, and so like 90% of the applicants were sopranos.
Yeah.
So, and they showed up.
Well, it's a really interesting thing. I know I've personally needed to take steps away from, even when it's things that I agree with conceptually, like where I'm just like the energy that is spent in Facebook groups is like,
as it, you may notice that I am not on Facebook now. I take 6 month breaks.
Yeah,
but it's exactly what you said. Even when you agree with it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm being yelled at for agreeing with you. Like I have unfriended more people or just unfollowed more people who I am completely in line with ideologically, and I'm just like, shut the fuck, like I just like,
yeah,
you know, because also especially the opera groups are just get to be such armchair quarterbacking, and it's like,
oh my god,
like, and you get just both sides like digging in, you know. I remember having a conversation with somebody about you know, but and this is something we have to deal with, sensitivity with hiring. If you're doing a Madame Butterfly, you probably don't want to go to like a white person first to get a Madame Butterfly. Having said that, if you've heard like 30 sopranos and the best, you know, and you don't have any really good options, like you know, you have to balance a lot of different things. And it's and so some people are like, oh, that's ridiculous, you can't be so PC. And it's like, yeah, but you're not going to get the hate mail if you don't hire an Asian butterfly. So like, I have to actually figure out like who can sing this, who is appropriate to singing this. And so like in October we're doing another piece that hasn't been done since the 1870s called Ali Baba, and it's another contemporary of Verdi's. And the problem I have with a lot of these operas like A Tango or Turco, both operas which I love, or mm-hmm. Abduction, is there's, you know, there's always like an othering element to it, right? So you have like, it's in a seraglio or whatever, and it's in some, you know, they got some big turbans, and so and there's always this like, well, there's them, and then there's you know, there's the weird, you know, sort of turban wearing Turks, and then there's us. But the nice thing about Ali Baba is that there is no other, because it's all, everybody's in the same world, right? Mm-hmm. They're all in Isfahan, Iran, or Iran, and so they're, you know, and we're not doing turbans and all, and I went out of my way to hire an Iranian director, and every single one of the leads is a person of color, you know, someone from Bangladesh, someone from a number of African Americans, someone from Turkey. So I was like, we're going to do this, and we're going to really do this, you know, but I also had like a lot of time, and it's also not Madame Butterfly, you know? So it's like, it's a very, and it was not easy to do either. You know, like I had to call like a lot of people, and I said, agents, I said, who do you have do you have any, you know, buddy of any Middle Eastern, you know, background, anything? And you have no idea how many agents have nobody. Wow. And or they'll have like a soprano, you know, but like I said, you know, do you have a bass, you know, or a bass? I need a bass who is of Middle Eastern, you know, descent. You know, I don't care if it's like five generations, you know, something like their last name, or like they have a parent or a grandparent. Like it got like further and further away from like my ideal, which was like, we're going to get Middle Eastern people to, you know, people from Iran or Iraq, you know, that went out the window immediately. Just realizing who is available, but it, you know, ultimately it's going to be kind of worth it, because we're going to, you know, we're going to have this completely diverse cast, which was, like I said, it's not easy to get to, but I'm glad we're doing it.
Well, and that, I deeply appreciate that, because that's just not done.
It's like, done. It is done sometimes. Like when Glimmerglass did an Aida, I believe in 2013, they did like an all African American Aida, which was kind of great. Like, and I mean like the apprentices and like everybody was.
Well, and cool. There's this company out in LA called Pacific Opera Project.
Where I've heard of them.
They're doing, I think they're really cool. I auditioned for them when I was doing the Young Artist Circuit, and they gave me a t-shirt after my audition that said, it said something along the lines of like, I flew all the way to New York and auditioned for Pacific Opera Project, and all I got was this crappy t-shirt or something like
right.
that. But like, it was, they're just like very, very self-aware, but they're doing this Madama Butterfly with an all similarly yeah. to what you're doing, I think all Japanese.
Wow.
Yeah. Like,
that's hardcore.
Yeah, which is wild.
That's tough. That's obviously the ideal. So yeah. That's the ideal. But opera is an art form about compromise. The ideal is also that, you want this orchestra with 16 first violins and stuff.
Right.
And they might not have that. So you're constantly compromising about what can you do? And how much rehearsal time can you possibly have? How many choristers do you have? Do you do the original version of Butterfly, or do you do the Brescia version, or everything is like a choice, but every choice has so many ramifications.
Well, and I love the way that you think about it in that. What one of the things that you were saying about is the harder that you've worked to get closer and closer to that ideal, you can feel it artistically, it seems.
You can feel it artistically, but you can also see how very far you have to go. I wanted an all Middle Eastern cast. I had to settle for people who were slightly darker than me. And even one guy is not that much, because I'm Italian, and he's sort of, he's Greek and he's or Turkish, and he's looks like you, but I had to completely give away the ideal so quickly, but I was holding on, and it's easy for me to, I'm a white guy, so it's I'm going to be this really benevolent person who hires all these people of color. But at the same time, it was sort of the right thing to do. We need to do this. And it's also a piece that we're not going to hear, no one's going to moan about why didn't you hire, this baritone who's obviously appropriate, with Butterfly, you're going to get that. Why didn't you hire so-and-so? She's great, even though she's not Asian. Nobody knows this piece. So no one's going to, get on my case about it.
That's so interesting. Well, I want to touch more on that piece too. I know that
sure.
It's something that's very, not that specifically, I think that it's very interesting, the work that you're doing in the less traveled.
Yes, that's my passion
of opera, because, I think that everybody knows that opera companies will very frequently do the same 10 operas.
Yep,
and that's, everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of two pieces for me in response to that, which is the one thing that we've talked about already, and we've talked about on the show a ton, which is new opera and the importance of new opera and balancing sure. it. But I also think that there's a lot of musicological work that's there to be done.
Absolutely.
In so much of, even with composers that we know.
Right.
And then
composers you've never heard of.
Once you get...
They were huge in their time.
You start learning some names like Spohr.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God. These people wrote multiple operas. And you don't even know... People don't even really know. You could pull a random name and people don't even know which one is this person's Bohème. Right. Because it's just not been explored like that outside of the time that it was written.
Right. And that is my, we don't do really a lot of new opera in Albuquerque. We do. So now we're up to three pieces, and sometimes years before. And one of the pieces is always going to be a Spanish language opera, because we perform in the National Hispanic Cultural Center, and Albuquerque is a completely bilingual city. Mm-hmm. And there's just several reasons we need, and it's always our best selling opera anyway. Right. So one piece is always going to be Spanish language. Then one is going to be really hardcore traditional, and then one is going to be off the beaten path. But once you start opening that can of worms of what's off the beaten path, there's so much out there. But the thing is, there is not a lot out there, in printed edition. So with Amleto, I spent 12 years putting this thing together, from microfilm literally yeah. A measure a day, just looking at this microfilm and say, okay, is that a B flat or is that a, but I got really good at it,
Right.
So after that with Alibaba, it took me just a couple years to put it together.
Yeah, I wanna talk more about this, because
just a couple years.
On and off. I do yeah, other things.
Yeah, right. I want to talk about resources.
It's not Penelope making the yeah.
how. I want to have recorded and verbalized in some way. What does the scene, the scope, the scene look like for folks that are in a position like yours where you're wanting to see stuff that is and maybe there are people that are listening that don't know what a microfilm is, but like sorry, can you explain? I realize I said that because I know concept. Like, what is a microfilm?
So microfilm is basically the way they used to store like lots, you know, like they would store books on it or like especially manuscripts.
Right.
And they would, and it's on this kind of film that you put it like on a, you have to go to a library or something and you put in the machine and it blows it up and it shows you what it is. And you can kind of scroll through it. And what I would, you know, this is like over 900 pages or something. And I made 11 by 17 copies of each page of the microfilm. But now they don't do that anymore. So like, thank God, because, you know, because when I got the microfilm, like I was away at a gig and I had it sent to my parents' house. And my mom said, this thing came in the mail. You know, what do you want me to do? And I said, can you go to the library and print out a few pages? So she was mailing me pages of this thing as it came out, you know, as she would, you know, print out like 20 of them and mail them to me. And then I would start like trying to, and it was just out of curiosity, you know, right. Like in the beginning, I was like, well, what does this sound like? You know, what does to be or not to be sound like? What does get thee to a nunnery sound like, you know, in Italian in with this orchestra? And so, but now they don't do really microfilm anymore. They take high resolution photographs and they send me like a little thumb drive.
Yeah.
Well, that's way better.
Well, and the Ricordi Archives in Milan has tens of thousands of manuscripts. Like you said, Louis Spohr, like people that, you know, you've never heard of. And even though, you know, we do three pieces a year and we don't really do a lot of new work, for all intents and purposes, Ali Baba is a new, you know, nobody alive has heard it. Right. Yeah. Nobody alive who knows anybody who's alive has heard it. You know, nobody alive, like even going a generation before me, there's nobody that knew it. And so, you know, we might not be doing new works written now, but I'm really interested in like, you know, this composer, Giovanni Bottesini, was a very important composer. He was called the Paganini of the double bass. He was a very famous conductor. He conducted the premiere of Aida in Egypt. He was extremely important as a musician, as a performer, as a conductor, as a composer. And this piece is just delightful. Like, I think it's so cool. And I, in my dream someday would just be like, you know, with Amleto has been done in Austria. It's been done in Delaware. It's been done in Germany since our production in Albuquerque, to kind of at least inject some new life into the repertoire, because people, maybe they don't want to hear, you know, they go, oh, I don't want to hear new opera because it sounds weird. Well, they don't know what they mean by that, right? You have to kind of train your audience for what they, but one thing I've discovered is that what they do want is they want to hear music that sounds like something that they know, but is not something they know, which is where this kind of repertoire is great. You know, like Ali Baba sounds like late Verdi or sort of middle Verdi and like late Donizetti. And so it's not going to be, you know, there's no atonal fugues in it. Right. So.
Well, this sounds to me like it's honestly, it sounds like archaeology.
It really is. It's like musicological forensic work for sure, because it and that's why I really love it, because it, you know, I was trained as a composer
or something. Criminal
Minds. Musicological Minds. No, but if you think about it, it's, you know, and so I studied composition, but I almost got a degree in music history, and putting together, especially with Amleto, like putting it together was really fascinating, because I was like, if I could get the bass line, because the bass is doing a B flat, and someone's singing a D, and then I'm looking at a horn note, is that it's probably an F, right? Like, because, you know, you can know through tonal harmony how these things work, you know, and even if it's faded and you can't really see all five lines, you can kind of put it together. So I was putting to use my knowledge of harmony, my knowledge of, you know, how bass works, how you flesh out an orchestra, things like, you know, the horns are in E now they're in E flat. And so like all of these things for the first time, like every bit of, you know, music knowledge that I learned in college was all of a sudden very much useful to me. You know, things I hadn't thought of in years, like, you know, like theory and the way a 5-7 chord resolves, and but it's like it's right there on the page, you know.
Well, and what the question I also want to ask is, if there are folks listening that are interested in starting this kind of work or understanding better how it could be started, like, what are your best pieces of advice? Like,
so I had the really great fortune of working a lot on works. So like, let's say works that have a very respected critical editions. So almost all the works of Rossini and almost all the works of Verdi have these critical editions that have been published by the University of Chicago in conjunction with Ricordi, and these have extensive notes in them. So you'll have, like, you know, the score will be this big, and then you'll have a, you know, 200 page booklet of notes. It'll say in measure 234, Verdi, there's a smudge on this, and it could be a coffee stain, but he could have meant it's a dotted eighth note instead of, you know. And so, like, and I mean the minutiae of these notes. So, like, I would read through all of these when I was preparing a score. That combined with the fact that Philip Gossett, who was the editor of the Rossini edition and the Verdi edition, you know, lived in Chicago. He only passed away a couple years ago. And through various friends, I got to meet him. And when I was working on Amleto, he was invaluable with advice. He would say, this is actually, that's a ledger line. That's not a, you know, that's not a flag on the note. And he was really great about guiding me through that. But it really was just a matter of just jumping in and having no fear with it and just saying, I wonder what this sounds like, you know, yeah. And having a curiosity.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to jump down to, like, a personal. I worked with Philip Gossett the last year.
You did? Life. Oh, wow.
I was an assistant editor on the like the vocal music.
Oh yeah, the Baron Rider. Wow.
And it's exactly what, like, it's one of those things where
the minutia is incredible.
Yeah, and his, like, so I don't know how much. I mean, it's probably fine. He had a degenerative illness.
Absolutely.
But it's like he was still very much Philip Gossett.
Well, yeah. And I saw him about 6 months before he passed away, and you could tell he was there for sure.
And we went through a lot of different things, but that, I think, more than anything, exactly how you say it, like that, I think there's something really to be said about the fact that because we have these pages and pages of how to in depth analyze and understand how a composer may have intended for their work to sound through these tombs. I think that, like, one of the things that I think is so interesting is figuring out how to translate that to these works that are less traveled.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, the nice thing is that all composers really until the 20th century kind of had the same way of composing. Like, they would compose the bass line and they would compose the vocal lines, you know, and that's how they started, you know, and they would go left to right and they would get like a basic skeleton sketch of the entirety. And then they would go back and they'd fill in the orchestration and things like that. But if you have the bass line and you have the vocal lines, you have the basic architecture, you have the foundation of the house. And everything else, it just kind of fits, especially if you really know tonal harmony well. And Philip was really great at kind of just showing me that and through his works with these other critical editions that he did so many of them. It's unbelievable to think about how much work he did.
And if that man had 10 or 20 more years, like, what? That was the thing that I was always so curious about, is like, well, because it was unprecedented.
How old was he when he died?
75.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's unprecedented, the, like, way in which, like, it, like, chronicling these composers. And, you know, one of the things that I also helped him with was cataloging just his personal library.
Oh my god, wow.
Yeah. And
this is when he had the two apartments, right? The one upstairs. Yeah. Oh my god.
And so a lot of his personal library were a lot of these manuscripts of composers that, you know, I somewhere, I think, wrote down or have, like, the names of just, like, these composers that I think were these areas of, like, kind of, this is just me plugging a project for 20 years from now, probably, but, like, I at some point really want to better understand kind of, like, what, you know, there is out there that maybe people were trying to figure out how to unpack and understand, like, these composers, like, because that's how I learned about, like, Spohr, and I'm like, yeah. I can't, anyway.
Well, but we said that there's 10 works that get done all the time, you know,
right.
and it's true. And the repertoire is kind of calcified, but why, you know, why is it this? Why do we hear the Puccini Boheme and not the Leoncavallo Boheme? You know, like, what it is better, you know, or like the Barber of Seville by Rossini versus Paisiello. You know, it's there are definite musicological reasons, right? But there are also political reasons, and there are also editorial reasons. Like, you know, so like when Puccini was coming up, you know, he was the guy that Ricordi said, we're going to put all our eggs in this basket. You know, there were other, you know, Catalani, there were other, Leoncavallo for sure, and Mascagni, other composers that they could have gone with, but for whatever reason they went with Puccini, and they went hard with Puccini, right? To the point where, like, when Verdi's last opera, Falstaff, was being premiered, every company in the world wanted that. This is Verdi's last opera. And Ricordi said, yeah, you can have Falstaff as long as you also program Manon Lescaut by Puccini. Like, they just tied it into these things economically. So Puccini had, you know, he obviously is a brilliant composer, and I don't want to take anything away from him. He's one of my favorite composers. But there were economic and political reasons that pushed him forward in a way that someone like, you know, Leoncavallo didn't. You know, ended up dying completely poverty-stricken, writing these little musicals, you know, like, he was sad.
Like, Puccini was the Ricordi poster child.
Yeah.
It was like, it benefited
absolutely
Ricordi to have Puccini be
absolutely
the star.
Yeah.
And it's, that is such a, it's, but, and I also think that, like, so, let me actually turn this into a question before I just start pontificating. This is the thing I always have a hard time with whenever we talk about something that I'm very interested in.
No, that's cool.
The journalist, like, kind of leaves, and the, like, thinker is like, but let me actually ask a question, which is, what do you think, when it comes to, you know, we've touched on the idea of there being 10 operas that we perform a lot, or even the works that have been pretty thoroughly researched and understood.
Yeah, yeah.
What are, for you, the things that you take from that, from those practices and traditionalist understandings, when it comes to applying to these operas that are less traveled? Like, what are your kind of guidelines?
It's kind of weird, because the top... Like, I always say there are six operas that are that if you do, you'll sell out, and if you don't sell out, you should just pack up and go home. And, you know, and they're Butterfly, Bohème, Tosca, Turandot, Aida, and Carmen. Sorry, so six. Those are the six ones. Pretty guaranteed, those are going to sell out. Everything else, like, whether it's Elixir of Love, or, you know, Balduin Mascara, or Così, or Don Giovanni, like, everything else is a real gamble. Like, you might sell out, you might not, you know. But those six should be, you know, gold. Having said that, those six, since they're done so much, have what I call barnacles just encrusted on them. So I don't know that the traditional repertoire has a lot to teach us about how other repertoire is, you know, that other repertoire from the same time period should be done, because I don't believe that a lot of the standard repertoire is done in a way that is in any way, has anything to do with the way it was intended to be done. I mean, at all. I mean, you know, Bohème, Barber, Seville, forget it. I mean, like, you know, these, there are so many of these traditions that are very 20th century traditions that are glommed onto, you know, important traditional works that I just think actually obfuscate the way you should do other works of that period.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think one of the things that Philip Gossett was most famous for was showing up to rehearsals where a singer would sing something.
Yep. Oh man, yeah.
Be like, no, that's not at all right.
Right. Yeah.
It's just wrong.
Yeah, we would never sing a high F there. Yeah, it would never happen. Yeah. Like, they wouldn't have even conceived of it happening that way. And he's got a great book. Have you read Divas and Scholars?
I mean, I actually haven't read it, but
it is one of the most influential books, at least on opera, that I've ever read. And he talks a lot about that. Like, you know, I always try to, whatever, whether it's Bohème, whether it's a new piece, whether it's this Ali Baba, whether it's Barber Seville, I always try to in some way recreate what it would have been like, you know, at the original performance. There's no way we can do it. You know, we don't have gas lights. You know, we don't have, we have orchestra pits. We have modern, you know, strings. We have modern brass. So, like, you're already, it's not going to happen, right? But on some level, like, when I found out that the original production of Don Giovanni had, like, Mozart had three first violins and three second violins and, like, one cello, like, I was like, that would be fascinating to do. And so we just did Lohengrin in Opera Southwest in Albuquerque. And obviously, I mean, my pit can hold maybe 50 people. It cannot hold 100 people like a traditional Wagnerian orchestra. But I love Lohengrin. I've always wanted to do it. And I thought, how could I possibly do it? And then someone told me once, and I researched this, and this is true, that the premiere of Lohengrin that was conducted by Liszt in Weimar, he was such a passionate believer in this piece, he did it, but he only had 38 musicians in the pit. And I was like, what would that have sounded like? Like, what would that have, like, that is just completely different. And the first woman who sang Elsa was like 23 years old. The first woman who sang Ortrud was 18 years old. Not that I'm going to get an 18-year-old and a 23-year-old right. to do it, but like the conception of what is a Wagnerian singer did not exist in Wagner's time. Like, there were no Wagnerian singers. Like, you sang Bellini and you sang, you know, Beethoven and you sang all this other stuff. So I really love approaching even standard repertoire works very differently than, you know, the way, you know, people think that Norma is such a perfect example. People think Norma needs to be this like canon that is just this enormous voice, but people who have an enormous voice can't move their voice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people who can really move their voice don't have a voice big, you know, so you have got to find a way to make both of these things work. That's one of the joys of being an artistic director, beyond just programming the kind of stuff that I think an audience should be able to digest, is to like, what singers do I think could maybe do something that, you know, if I program this singer to do this, you know, someone might think that's ridiculous, but then after they hear it, they might go, wow, that's a really interesting way to program that soprano role. You know, I'd never thought of it that way.
Wow. So I know we have like a couple minutes left before we have a couple minutes left. So yeah. I have a question.
Sure.
So I know that you do a lot of work elsewhere and a little bit of work here.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, we are pretty hyper focused on what is happening in Chicago.
Yes.
And as someone who has the perspective of creating art everywhere, mm-hmm. What do you think, this is going to sound like I'm like putting Chicago down, but I'm not.
Okay.
What do you think, based on what you've gleaned in producing other places, that Chicago could learn from other places?
I mean, you're going to be hard pressed to have me say anything bad about Chicago.
I
actually think it's the other way around. I think other people can learn from Chicago.
Fantastic.
I think Chicago, like New York, is just, you know, I like Chicago personally better than New York, but I was born and raised in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I'm a Chicago boy at heart. I love Chicago, you know, almost a distraction. So I might not be the right person to ask about that because
vice versa.
So I think that, you know, there's a lot of, we have probably the best symphony in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we have great music schools. We have two phenomenal opera companies, you know, world-class opera companies. We have lots of other smaller opera companies. We have so much music going on that even like with Chicago Folks Opera, where I'm music director, you know, we can get an orchestra of people that are made up, some of students, some of people who are professional musicians gigging, that will be just as good, if not better, than a regional orchestra like somewhere else. You know, like, we have so many qualified musicians. I mean, and like, on my end, that's fantastic, because there's so much to choose from. Even like when we hear apprentices, when we heard them in Chicago, like, we heard a lot of good people in Chicago. But, you know, having said that, there's more people not working, you know, so like, you know, from an arts point of view, it's just a rich, you know, it's rich for the mining, but it's also rich for the exploitation, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not to be a bummer at the end of the show, but
no,
it's,
no, no,
it's,
I mean,
but
it's very
true. It's, but it's, you know, there are more qualified singers now than probably in history, and there are fewer jobs, and there are more, and these, and you know, it's easy to blame opera companies. It's easy to blame apprentice programs, but you know, I say it's the fault of music schools. I really very strongly believe that music schools are crazy. You know, they're about making money. They're about staying in existence. They tell students who have no business being in music to stay with it because they mm-hmm. need the check. And, mm-hmm. and singing, I mean, singing teachers are just some of the worst people on the planet. You know, like, they're musical terrorists. Like, they encourage such codependency and such unhealthy. I mean, I can go off on singing teachers forever, but I think it starts so early, and then people get disillusioned, and mm-hmm. you know, it's tough. It's really tough.
Well, and even if you, because I don't disagree with you, the thing I do try to think about to try and like think about optimistically is like, even if you take it and look at it like you just have a surplus labor problem, like like, okay, what can we do, you know, like what is the, and with Chicago it's a perfect example where there are just so many singers here. Yeah. There's so many, and like every singer is like, I'm gonna start an opera company,
right?
And that's great, like conceptually.
Conceptually.
but then it's you gotta, at a certain point you gotta wonder like, well,
even what? To like run a bad opera company is fucking hard, like, you know, that's yeah. that's the thing. So then the a lot of the problem is a lot of people who are not getting, you know, work, they said, well, I'll just make my work, which, like you said, conception is a great idea. But then what happens when you have a bunch of people who really shouldn't be doing it, producing opera, and then someone who doesn't know anything about opera comes and sees that, and they see something shitty, and they go, oh, that's what opera is.
And then you have a culture of people, a community of people that are relying on those opportunities,
right,
for better or for worse,
yeah,
to be their performance outlet. And so you have right. hundreds of people in a city, and like, this sounds so, I do not mean to say that like these people are, I think that there's a lot to, I think there's a, like, I've spent a good chunk of my artistic time just finding work performance opportunities that I could get, you know?
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
And doing that. And there's so much to learn as a performer. I think that there are so many performers that need the experience of being one of the hundreds of people in Chicago.
Well, and it's amazing for forging friendships.
I mean, sure. There absolutely. Are,
like, it's, and if, you know, music, if musical and theatrical excellence is not your end goal,
right?
Like, if like being the cream of the crop, if being the best opera produced in the world is not your goal, then like, that's, and like relationships,
that's okay. Yeah.
And like relationships and you know, feeling personally artistically fulfilled, like that is huge. And that is hugely important. But I mean, I think that where we run into trouble is where people start to conflate that type of work being done with like,
but even I know singers who are singing and have decent careers who still have to work a second job. It's like, so like,
oh, yeah.
even like when success is so,
oh yeah,
so very different, based, you know, if you're singing in the church basement, for even if you're singing at the in the Chicago Opera Theater chorus, like that's maybe a little step higher, but you're still not making ends meet. So like, so I guess I just wish that there was a mechanism from conservatory or even before that on, whereby singers, like, if you're hungry for that performance experience, if that's what you really want more than anything, or even if it's not, even what if you just love is the music making or the singing, I wish there were more singers who would just, instead of singing in the church basement spaghetti dinner opera, they would just go, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try and read Dante's Inferno in Italian. Like, I'm going to, instead of like wasting a, you know, 3 months learning an opera, you know, that no one's going to come to. And, you know, you could completely enrich your life by trying to like read this thing or to like just do an analysis of the libretto of Falstaff or something like that, which I mean, maybe I'm just like a nerd or something, but that is something that really, like, that is way more, you know, spiritually and artistically nourishing than doing, you know, the church basement opera. Like, and I wish that was that, but that's not as flashy, you know, that's not as,
I also, the external deadline thing is an interesting thing to me, not to say, cause I agree with you. Like, I think that like study is, independent study is like, I think that it's neglected, honestly.
Yeah.
But I also think that there's something to be said about, even if you're doing it, like in a church basement, like
it's
that,
gonna, there's
that
a deadline,
deadline
yeah.
of
yeah.
this performance has
but
to
but you can
up.
Make a deadline for yourself, you know, like, and that's tough. I know it is, but yeah. you can do it. Like, you know, it's, people do it. They've mm-hmm. done it since the beginning of time. You can go, I'm going to read, you know, like this week, it's like, for example, I said, I'm going to read, you know, I've never read Beloved by Toni Morrison. So like this week, I was like, I'm going to read it. I'm going to read 33 pages a day. I'm going to just freaking do it. Like, I'm going to mm-hmm. do it. And it's been, you know, wonderful. Like, some days I don't really want to read it, you know, but it go, I read it anyway. And I don't know, I feel like it, with sort of like self-discipline, but that's what I'm saying. If it goes back to this conservatory training, if you're taught that like this, you know, learning an Italian language can be fulfilling beyond just the fact that it's going to get you to the Met, you know, mm-hmm. it's going to be fulfilling for several reasons.
That's where it's like, so my bachelor's, I went to Peabody Conservatory.
Oh, you did? Okay. I did, yeah. Oh, Baltimore. Go Baltimore.
Yeah. And my background growing up, like I started taking voice lessons when I was like 12 or something from a lady in the neighborhood. And, but my background, like my initial like musical, you know, deep dive was in like folk and bluegrass and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to college, I was told in no uncertain terms, I'm sorry, but that's not the kind of music that you're going to do here.
Right.
Which makes no sense to me because, I mean, like, I get right. that at Peabody there is no folk singing department, but, like,
right.
like
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, but what's so frustrating to me is, like, you have a young person who is passionate
about music. Right.
And, like, that's not to say that I was walking into my voice lessons being like, I will not sing Susanna because instead I want to sing Will the Circle right, Be Unbroken. Yes, exactly. I also wanted to do that.
But you can want do both.
Exactly. Yeah. But what was so frustrating is like, I was basically told if you want a career in music, you cannot like any, you cannot you can't be like. Pursuing and you cannot pursue any other kind.
Wow.
Which is so ridiculous because that is so not representative of what the musical sphere is.
I mean, yeah. And I've
gotten more gigs in opera because I can play ukulele, guitar, and mandolin than just me being able to sing.
Well,
which,
I mean, maybe
it means I'm a bad singer.
I don't know. But you're right. Like, I wonder, like, because I never studied conducting. If I had studied conducting, if I had gone to Aspen or Tango and done all like the right things with the right pedigree, like I probably wouldn't be doing this. I'd probably be going to these like, I'd probably be teaching university and going to like conducting clinics and, you know, like doing these academic things. Like I think if you love music, you have to like, nothing's going to stop you from loving, you know, folk music, you know, nothing's going to stop me from listening to Nine Inch Nails or, you know, Run the Jewels. Like it's going to, I'm going to still listen to it. Like, it's not going to be, that is odd. I mean, it's because, but this, again, this kind of goes back to what I said in the beginning. Music now is, it's really complicated for me because I have a love hate relationship with music. I need to get away from it. Sometimes, like the way you're talking about Facebook, like I need to get away from it. I need to hear nothing a lot or just have a conversation.
The summer between my freshman and sophomore years at undergrad, I didn't listen to any music and I read 50 books because I was
awesome.
I was like, my ears are tired. And I just like, cause I, it was like, you know, second semester we were doing all of these like tests where we had to listen to like 50 art songs and be able to identify them. Like we would have
this
ridiculous listening tests. And by the end of it, I was like, I can't listen to anything else. I just need to read.
Sir Simon Rattle talks about how he, in the middle of his musical studies, he took a year off of listening to music. Like, didn't listen to music for a year. And then when he came back to it, I think he went to a concert and heard some Beethoven symphony, and he just started weeping copiously. And I thought, if I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how could you go a year? You wouldn't, you'd have to, like, not go anywhere. You'd have to not go.
When was that?
I don't know. I think it was, you know, it was probably like in the 70s or something, or the 60s. You could have gotten away with it a little bit more.
Right.
You couldn't watch TV.
Couldn't go to a grocery store.
You couldn't go to a grocery store. You couldn't go to any restaurant. You couldn't go to Walgreens. So I'm thinking, I was like, could I do that for a month? No. No. Could I do it for a week? Could I do it for like a weekend? And I want to try it this summer. Like, do it for a weekend. No music. And just see what that would be like.
Mm-hmm.
That would be tough. I would have to not leave my house. I'd have to not even look at a score because then I would sort of kind of go in my head.
Yeah.
You know?
You wouldn't be able to watch television.
Nope. You'd have to put it on mute.
Yeah.
You know?
That'd be wild.
I think it'd be a fantastic experience. So I think if your listeners, you know, anybody who does
that. Be the next 30-day challenge. These are really big right now, these 30-day challenges videos. Like every YouTuber ever is like, I go 30 days.
And what kind of stuff?
I spent
eating only worms, right?
I meditate an hour every day for 30 days.
I spent 30 days doing the same workout routine as a ballerina.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 30 days.
But then after 30 days, you're done, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then there's the last 2 minutes of the video are like, what did I learn? I learned that being a ballerina is so hard.
That's wonderful. God. I didn't know that being a ballerina was hard. I wouldn't have known that.
Who'd have thought? Thank God for that video.
But damn, it doesn't make a good thumbnail. You know,
there's like, no way that I get. Not one of those YouTubers can go 30 days without listening to music. It would be impossible. It would be impossible. We'll and maybe in prison that. You could do it.
Yeah. Anybody listening, make the hashtag Anthony Barese challenge a thing. Let's go. Let's do it.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
This is it's been an absolute blast. The last thing we do with our guests is a 1 minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes it's very obvious, like letting people know where they can find your work or find any performances that you have upcoming. We also love hearing shout outs to the folks that are doing dope work or any media that you're consuming personal.
Oh my God, that's all. Another hour. Okay. So you can get see my stuff. All my music is available for download and listening on anthonybarese.com, BARRESE.com. I'm going to be doing a number of performances of operetta with the Chicago Folks Operetta in July, a piece by Paul Abram called Flower of Hawaii. And then obviously a plug for this Ali Baba in Albuquerque in October, if you happen to be in Albuquerque. As far as media that I am personally consuming right now, I'm hate watching Game of Thrones. I am
what do you mean
I am back on board with Barry very much, and I've
heard very good things about
and I
show.
Very much am mourning the ending of Veep. So other than that, I'm on a project now that I'm trying to read every Pulitzer Prize winning book between the year I was born and now. So now I'm on Beloved now, which is 1988. So it's there are some great things and there are some just boring
that's
shit.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see, like, you know, there's like a 5 year period where this thing was clearly in, and then this thing was clearly in, and then we're going around this thing. You know, it's really interesting.
It is really interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, now I want to go look at the list.
You should look at the list, and it's an interesting list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we're up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first is head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our articles and podcast episodes there. You can also keep up with us on social media on Facebook. We have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board, where we talk about local arts, local politics, and astrology memes. Otherwise, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, spelled the same way as the website, S-C-A-P-I-M-A-G. And you can find the podcast, the one you'll listening to right now in most podcast places, including Google Play, iTunes Podcast, and Radio Public under Scopy Radio.
And I'm here, as always, to talk about the importance of subscribing. If you head to our website, scopymag.com, and go to our subscribe page, there are a couple ways that you can do that. The first is to sign up for email blasts. This is huge because even though we post across social media platforms, Facebook buries our content. So if you want to see 100% of what we're doing and not just 30% of it, you should sign up for those email blasts. The second thing you can do is become a member. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us keep our lights on and keep our website operational. If you're in a position to do so, there are some cool incentives associated with it, so please give it some thought. Also, we have merch for sale. If you head to scopymag.com/store, you can buy your new favorite shirt, and that is a promise. Also, if you are a business or an entity or just have something fun to say and want to advertise with us, please feel free to reach out to us at scopymag@gmail.com. So, give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.